I'm Debbie Draby from the Clinical Excellence Commission, and I'm pleased you can join us for this four-part series with Dr. Nick O'Connor and Dr. Catherine Turner. This podcast is part four of a four-part series on restorative just culture. In this segment, insights from experience implementing restorative just culture includes a reflection on the barriers and challenges for health services that are wanting to implement a restorative just culture. Catherine talks about the significant challenges of building that understanding of what restorative just culture is, and also explaining that level of accountability that's required across the whole organization. Feedback from clinicians involved in implementation has been quite positive, and they've expressed that they felt safe and been really engaged in this different approach where they have felt heard and considered. Particularly when there's an opportunity to build an understanding of what actually happened surrounding an incident. Catherine also describes some positive changes in Gold Coast mental health services with positive outcomes related to fewer people feeling or fearing disciplinary action and feeling that defensiveness. It seems that there was more trust in the organisation, and the people who were involved in the incident felt a greater sense of organisational support. Also, there's been a tremendous shift, particularly when people who have felt traumatised in the past following an incident, there's a sense of strengthening of the individual and relational resilience following an incident. There's also been a shift in quality and strength of recommendations. And whilst this is complex, Catherine describes opportunities for this to continue to grow through sustaining and, you know, maintaining those principles of restoring, maintaining those principles of restorative just culture, which can often be tough, particularly when we're looking at and exploring the importance of that tougher accountability that is shared across the organisation. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
Catherine, I just wanted to ask you, there are, I think, some barriers and challenges for health services that are wanting to implement a restorative just culture. I mean, one that I've already encountered is that actually, if you go to a local health district or a sector service and you want to implement this, they exist within the bigger health system, which then also exists within the politics of government and the wider society. And in some ways, people in society and often in politics and the health bureaucracy don't really understand the language or the sort of mental model of restorative justice. What are some of the barriers that you have encountered in implementing this?
So I think it's very true that many people don't understand what it's all about, and what they don't understand that it's actually a more accountable process than the traditional just culture approach or retributive approaches. It actually requires significant investment by everybody into the process, which can be, we've had some wonderful sort of feedback from clinicians, and they don't say this is a lovely process and, we've enjoyed. They say it's a tough process, but it's so much better than what we used to have because we felt safe to be able to really comprehensively review and really understand what actually happened. So getting people to understand the concepts is a challenge, and particularly people at higher levels in the organisation or clinicians, as I said, because it was very much a response to all the ideas that our clinicians had. There wasn't much resistance from clinicians around it, although there was a past experiences, there was probably a wariness about whether we were actually going to do what we said we were going to do. And people have been traumatised by incidents in the past, and it's very hard to let that go until you've really experienced a different approach. So the challenge is to For us, I guess it was to at least get permission or allow us to proceed. People above us didn't necessarily have to understand the intricacies of it, but, you know, the fact that they gave us permission to be able to do a slightly different process, you know, was really important. The challenge is also about, you know, sustaining and keeping to the principles as well. And sometimes that's because it is actually a tough accountability. Some people, you know, might be reluctant to do that. Some people might fear bringing people, bringing certain stakeholders in, or might feel that a family, you know, may not want to be part of the process, or they may be too angry to be part of the process. But in our experience, if we work with them and they understand that we are being open and transparent and we want to learn, in nearly every occasion, we've been able to engage families in that. So we actually, you know, you have to sort of be quite firm, I guess, about maintaining the principles. So it does require that ongoing effort. It's not a project that you do and then everything's changed and you go along. It's actually an ongoing conversations, you know, all of the time.
What have been the outcomes at Gold Coast Mental Health and Specialist Services where this approach has been implemented over the last few years?
Yeah, so we looked at a range of ways of measuring that. So we had a staff survey as part of the zero suicide implementation. So we've had that, you know, at least three times. In the second staff survey, we inserted a couple of tools to measure just culture and second victim experiences. And then we're able to repeat that in the third staff survey. We were also able to insert a question about whether someone had been, you know, been a recipient of the Always There peer responder. And what we were able to demonstrate in the staff survey was that there were significant improvements in a sense of sort of just culture and second victim distress. Fewer people feared disciplinary action. There was more trust in the organisation, and those people who had involvement with Always There had a greater sense of organisational support for them. So the other things that we looked at were, you know, the triage register. So we kept a register of all the incidents to see if we were doing what we said that we were doing. Are we moving away from RCAs? Are we looking at a broader range of incidents? Are we looking at a broader range of ways to review those incidents as well? Are we engaging all stakeholders in that, et cetera? So there was, and certainly we demonstrated that we'd, you know, had a huge change in moving away from RCAs. And we had a much broader range of incidents that we were learning from. We also did sort of an audit of the process, which demonstrated that we were, you know, engaging stakeholders, et cetera. Then we also looked at, you know, the quality and strength of recommendations. So we did a pre and a post audit of the strength and the quality in terms of SMART sort of outcomes, SMARTer for the, you know, the recommendation statements. And what we demonstrated is that there was improvements in the quality and the strength of recommendations. So improved effectiveness and evaluation, and more specific recommendations, and also an improvement in the strength of recommendations. But the literature would tell you that strength of recommendations is often very low. So we started from very low and we improved it a bit, but there's lots that aren't strong recommendations. And I think that then is another piece of work to really think about and really question our concept of strength of recommendations as well, that you know, if we're talking about, you know, that's a very, probably a very linear concept, the hierarchy of hazard controls, that we measure the strength of recommendations. And, you know, there may be more resilient healthcare approaches to care that may actually be stronger recommendations, or you may actually, and this is our experience, I think, you may actually have a number of less strong recommendations, but that build on one another, and that can be a very, you know, significant impact on the service. So I think we do need to rethink, you know, what is a good recommendation, and how can we embed resilient healthcare principles more into that? But I think that's an ongoing piece of work.
That is an ongoing piece of work. And the thing that I have been wondering about is that whether this approach, in addition to producing sort of fairly standard recommendations in terms of, you know, they're usually about processes and procedures and stuff, that it might also have an effect in terms of strengthening the individual and relational resilience, the ability for clinicians and teams to initiate and take initiative when required, even if you're stepping outside of an established procedure, but that's what the situation requires. Catherine, thank you so much for a really wonderful discussion about restorative just culture and the benefit of your experience in leading now your second service on that quest. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast series with Dr. Nick O'Connor and Dr. Catherine Turner on restorative just culture. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please note this is one of a four-part series, and I hope you listen to the other three segments as Nick and Catherine continue to take us on a journey exploring their experiences and their insight into restorative just culture. This four-part series includes conversations around practical implementation of restorative just culture and what it looks like in healthcare. Catherine will share her experiences on implementing the restorative just culture framework in mental health services and the impact that this has had on the management of incidents. And she'll give some really practical examples around this. I hope you enjoy the remainder of this series. I'm Debbie Draby from the Clinical Excellence Commission, and I'm pleased you can join us in this conversation with senior leaders on the guiding principles of effective morbidity and mortality meetings in action. This podcast series aims to explore the experiences and insights from leading M&M meetings. Look out for more podcasts as we continue this conversation and clinicians share their journey and learning. I hope you find it useful, and if you'd like to contribute to this conversation, please contact me.